Good evening and welcome back to another week of the Alaska Identity Project. My name is Adrienne Lopez, broadcasting here on KTOO News Juneau, 104.3 in Alaska's capital city. We've got a great show coming up for you tonight. In the first half hour, I'll be interviewing Ketchikan-born author, photographer, and artist Larry Johansson on his recent book, Alexander 18, exploring the 18 wilderness areas that exist within the Alexander Archipelago. And then from 7:30 to 8 p.m., I'll be airing a pre-recorded Skype interview I did with Brian P. Schmidt, the 2011 Nobel Prize winner in physics, for providing evidence that the expansion of the universe is accelerating. Schmidt is a graduate of Bartlett High School in Anchorage, so there's his Alaskan connection. Look for the Alaska Identity Project on Facebook. You can post a question there on my wall and also like the project or the show. And follow us on Twitter at Alaska ID Project. Finally, you can go to my blog, adriennechile.blogspot.com, and see all of the different interviews and find recordings of past ones on there, on that blog spot. A quick reminder for those in Juneau, if you're here next Friday, February 3rd, there'll be Juneau World Affairs Council is having their World Quest, which is an annual fundraiser for the organization. It'll be a buffet, no-host bar, silent auction, and an amusing trivia contest at 6:30 p.m. at Centennial Hall. That's Friday, February 3rd, World Quest, sponsored by the Juneau World Affairs Council. Ketchikan-born Larry Johansson is a third-generation Alaskan. His grandfather moved to Ketchikan from Norway in the 1920s. Larry's photography went from being a hobby to a business when he founded Rowdy Dog Images and started taking pictures of boots, here in Southeast, also known as Extra Tufts, being worn around not just Southeast Alaska, but around the state. He self-published Extra Tough, An Alaskan Way of Life in 2010, and will soon be publishing another book titled Alexander 18, which explores the 18 wilderness areas that exist within the Alexander Archipelago. Larry, thanks for coming on the show tonight.
Sure. Thank you for having me.
Taking the time to be on the show. I have to admit, when I moved back to Alaska last year, a friend asked me to go hiking, and he told me to get my Extra Tufts on, and I did not know what they were. And I grew up in Valdez, but we only wore pack boots, and so you say it's an Alaskan boot, but maybe not.
Well, I considered it to be the boot of the rainforest, and I think you've got a bumper sticker already made up there, get your Extra Tufts on. I think that's a slogan that when people hear that, they know that the going is going to get rough, and hence the overall concept of the Extra Tough being related to a lifestyle as well as a boot.
True. It's not just a boot. So just for those out there who are listening or who will listen to this recording in the future, just give us some background on the Extra Tough. What does it look like? Where is it made, etc.?
Well, probably the reaction that most people get when they come to Alaska and are told that they need to get a pair of Extra Toughs, they look at them and say, no way, Jose, am I going to put those boots on. But then you always see these same characters wearing them probably within a few weeks when they realize that comfort is head over heels more important than style. And maybe part of the idea of the book was that it's developed into its, because it's there's such functional and obvious and in their purpose that they've developed their own style. Come to characterize a people like no other item or icon that I could think of in the land of individualism. Everybody wears Extra Tufts, from the old school to new, hip, the cool, the young, the old, the in, the out.
Everybody
wears Extra Tufts. It defines people who live in the rainforest for sure.
So, actually, Amy Fisher, when she wrote a Juneau Empire article, when you published the book in 2010, she mentioned, but Southeast Alaskans' unusual and widespread appreciation for this particular brand, especially in a place that shuns conformity, largely defies reason. So it's a place where people don't necessarily conform, but yet there's this widespread appreciation for the boot, right?
Yeah, and I think that it is kind of like being issued your certificate or your visa to Alaska. If you're deemed worthy enough to wear Extra Tufts, it's like some people say, well, you're not really an Alaskan until you survived a winter. You earn your badge when you survive a winter. But I think Extra Tufts can be put in that category. When you buy your first Extra Tufts, you ain't moving back.
Oh, really? I haven't bought a pair yet. But I'm 9 months here.
There
but,
you go.
But
it's
the more it's more Southeast Alaskan when you say, because I mean you travel around the state. Do you, you see them more in this part of the state than other parts, right?
Yeah, it definitely. And when I decided to write the book, I had no grand plans for it to be a huge seller, because people still outside of Southeast Alaska don't really get what it is. But you can almost tell people from Southeast Alaska when they see the book, when I'm at a book signing or they ask me about it, the immediate reaction is smiles and laughters, which because they understand right away that what it means to put on a pair of the boot. And people not from Alaska are not quick to grasp the intangibles that are associated with the book, the mini stories and the way that it captures a lifestyle that a lot of things don't or can't as well.
Yeah, definitely. Now, you talk about that, the relationship with the environment around Southeast. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. You see a lot of books. There's a lot of books out there about Alaska and the beauty and the glaciers and the art and the animals. And one of the reasons why I wanted to write it was because I've never seen a book, really, that focuses on the culture of the people who live here. And that was kind of the idea of wanting to do a project like that. So I thought about it and thought about it, and then I didn't really know that I had enough material for a book when I started the project. I actually decided to take a few pictures and see what I could gather, and then I made a commitment to myself that I would go out at least once a day, no matter what. Usually at lunch break, I'd be having my camera going out and see if I could take a picture or somebody or something to do with XtraTough. It took several months, and then it started turning into more of a detective story than anything else. Because as I would ask people, you know, would it be okay if I took your picture? And you know, first reaction would be, you want to take a picture of me? And I said, well, not really your boots. And, oh, my boots? Well, of course, no problem. You can take
like an instant connection kind of, right?
Exactly. It was disarming to know that it was just boots.
Not you. You're not cute.
But it was disarming in that way, and usually it led to a conversation and about my project, and usually leads as to who I should talk to next. And they would be part of the story and say, "Well, you know, you really got to talk to so and so. They've got five pairs, and they decorated them, and their whole family has them." And then I would look them up, and they would lead me to somebody else, and the story just got bigger and bigger, and I was able to come up with some. The book kind of progresses. I slowly start off with the story of how they got interested because the fishermen wore them, and it was very functional, that they were very good traction. In fact, there's a picture also in there of my grandfather it's almost 100 years old.
Wow.
It predates XtraTough, but the boot was made by B.F. Goodrich, and the company that produced them was in Ohio, and they bought the brand from the B.F. Goodrich, but my grandfather actually, you can see this picture, that the little familiar square that XtraTough has. So it's been in Alaska for a long time and developed a kind of a reputation among the fishermen, and I think that's where it got its bravado, so to speak. It's Alaskan by the fishermen that wore it. In fact, some skippers would not allow anything else on the vessel except XtraTough. And the loggers came later, and steel toe, and I think that's where it became definitive of being the outdoor rough Alaskan lifestyle. And then people every day, kids going to school in the slush, realize, hey, they're pretty good, and I think that's where the core of it all started, and progressed from there.
Mm. So you kind of highlight different stories in this book. Could you profile a few other people? Like, there's politicians that wear them and models. And
yes. Well, I had to ask some obvious questions. The politician to speak of was Dennis Egan, who was a great sport about it. I've known Dennis for a while, and he's definitely a rainforest, knight of the rainforest, put it that way.
He
has wonderful personality, and I said, I've got three pair myself. Which pair do you want me to wear? And he was working on the Capitol in his office on a Saturday, and he said, yeah, sure, come on down. I've got a pair on right now. And so we walked into one of the meeting rooms, and he... Unsurprisingly, like a lot of Alaskans, I was taking a picture of Dennis, and then several of the other legislators said, how about me? I've got a pair. It's like a stampede to get your picture taken with extra tufts in the Capitol. But Dennis was the first one, so I got my politician is what I wanted to, trying to illustrate the fact that everybody wore them. One of the pictures was a really neat one. I was walking down the street on my daily journey to try to find somebody with extra tufts, and I saw a fellow named Mike who's wandering streets with a little dog. He was a former big machine operator, and he and his dog you could tell that they were instantly best buds, that he really loved this little dog, and started talking with him, sat down for a while, and learned his story, and asked him if I could take a picture of him and his dog with the boots on. And I didn't know at that time, but that a book was going to come of it. And so I saw him about a year later, and he was with his little dog, and I went up to him and said, hey, Mike. I ran back to my car. I got a copy of the book that I happened to have.
Yeah.
I said, who's this guy? He recognized himself and his little dog, and he was just thrilled that he was in the book, and put a smile on his face that his dog was famous. Not so much that he was famous, he was in a book, but that was a neat story. And some of the people that I had to... needed permission. Sandra Bullock was when I did some research to see who the most famous person was that wore extra tufts, and I was able to get a hold of a publicity company that I had to write the caption on very within guidelines in order to be able to use the picture. But everybody likes the one of Sandra Bullock.
Yeah. In the movie The Proposal, right?
The Proposal,
she's running
correct.
Around with that small
right.
dog.
Right, with the eagle swooping down. The one that was supposed to take place in Sitka, but really was filmed someplace else.
Probably Vancouver, yeah.
Right. But the last question, I was almost ready to wrap it up the book, and then I walked by the tattoo shop, and I had to ask.
If somebody's had a tattoo done?
If somebody had a tattoo done.
Of an extra tough.
And that's how... Temple Project got involved with the book, and she was doing a calendar of extra tufts and for charity, and Way Out was the name of her organization. Her and her friends were doing a calendar, and Temple gave me a picture of a tattoo that she had done in the middle of her back with an extra tuft on it. She was quite a character.
Her name is Temple Project?
No, her name is Temple. That was her project.
Okay.
Right. And just a heart of gold, and somebody who was really wanting to give back to the world. And I found that a neat story. So the book, again, was about, for me, it was a journey of meeting lots of people. And I had probably more fun actually writing it. And it became everybody's book who was in it, actually. I think there was a lot of pride and a lot of excitement about having a book written about us,
yeah.
The people.
Yeah, And so you do well with the sales. You sell around town, southeast.
Oh, it's southeast. Yeah, I probably got my money back. It's done pretty well, but it's kind of a project that you don't do to get rich because it's.
I know.
Yeah.
You self-publish it, right?
I self-published, and I've got the shirt on my back, so that's good. Right.
Very good. And if people are out there interested, again, to remind listeners, I'm talking to Larry Johansson. He published your first book, Extra Tough, An Alaskan Way of Life, which I met you when I went to the public market this year and bought the book, a couple copies for family members
who
don't live in Alaska right now. And so if they also want to go onto your website, it's Rowdy Dog Images, right?
Rowdy Dog Images and .com. And all the independent Alaskan bookstores carry it from Bellingham up to Homer, and Hearthside has it. They've all been very great to work with in advocating for Alaskan authors. And I don't know if I'm quite ready to call myself an author, but it's a project that's been a lot of fun. And
Well, great. Well, that was one of them, and the other one is this book that is going to soon be published called Alexander 18.
Right. This one is. I think Extra Tough gave me the confidence to go out and do something perhaps a little bigger and a little more, say more important, but probably a bigger issue. And it's also been an amazing journey. Wilderness area, in 1964, there was an act, probably the most significant act, passed by Congress defining wilderness and what wilderness is. And probably the best thing to do is to, there's a difference between a wilderness area and a national park. And the Wilderness Act of 1964 describes it in this way. It's a wilderness in contrast to those areas where man and his own works dominate the landscape is hereby recognized as an area where the earth and its community of life are untrammeled by man, where man himself is a visitor who does not remain. Which is the primary difference between a park and a wilderness area. And it's probably the highest level of protection that can be granted to a land area there. And there are 18 total within the Alexander Archipelago. And if you're wondering where the Alexander Archipelago is, most people who are listening to this are in it. It's the Southeast Alaska collection of islands. There are actually 19 total in the Tongass National Forest. There's a wilderness area by Yakutat, the Tatchachini. But I was focusing on the 18 that are within the panhandle. And I started off, I've been to several of them, and I decided to go to each one of them and to document, photograph, and discover each one. My goal was to first of all to introduce them to people, because a lot of people didn't know what a wilderness area was, or even people who were living next to one didn't know that what its special designation was, or even how they came to be. And there are many issues in wilderness, many ideas that were introduced in the Wilderness Act that are being managed today, are issues that are involved in the wilderness that are important for the propagation, the future of the wilderness areas. Mm-hmm. So what I've tried to do is to look at these common issues, these common difficulties, these characteristics of the wilderness, and choose the wilderness that best represented that particular area and tell its story. So some of the wilderness areas lend itself better to doing that than others. And maybe to give you an example of what some of the wilderness areas are, many of you are familiar with Tracy Arm.
Yes.
There are Misty Fjords, Admiralty Island are wilderness areas.
Mm-hmm.
Leconte Glacier. Some of the ones that are not so well known are a few that I hadn't gotten out to was Coronation Island, which is an island off of Prince of Wales Island,
okay,
which is I've lived in Alaska, like you mentioned. I've been born and raised here and been to a lot of parts of Alaska. But truly beautiful country that if I hadn't in my 50 years of living here had not had a chance to get out to see some of these, then a lot of people probably haven't as well. But
True.
There are many treasures out there in Southeast Alaska that the purpose of the book, I think, is to point them out and to introduce them to people and to really show that these wilderness areas, by the definition of the Wilderness Act, are really the 18 wilderness areas in the United States that are probably the biggest, the most important, the brightest, the superstars of a wilderness area as a definition.
Okay, but more than like other areas of Alaska, maybe, would you say?
Oh, Alaska is by far and away a different than the rest of the United States. And maybe the point that I make in the book is that nowhere in the Southeast in the United States can you be anywhere theoretically more than a day walk from the nearest road.
True.
In Alaska, that's not true. You could be dropped off in the middle of someplace and be weeks
and never
find your way back and traveling for. So that kind of dislocate that really solid definition, profound definition of wilderness is, I think, is only available, at least in the United States, in Alaska. And I have had the fortune of traveling around many places in the world as well. I've been to nearly 40 countries and been to Asia, and I've climbed in the Himalayas and climbed the highest mountain in the Western Hemisphere and been to some really exotic, far-off places. But they all held some sort of a tie or a link to civilization in a way that some of the wilderness areas in Alaska just take you away from that.
Mm-hmm.
And it came to me probably when I was writing this book that these areas that people were not aware of needed to be basically introduced. And that's the purpose of the book is mostly photographs.
Okay.
I've started off to go to each one and in discovery. It wasn't my goal to do this, but I could possibly be the first person who ever has
been to all 18.
Been to all
of
18,
them.
Right? When I first started, I figured that somebody at the Forest Service must have
been to
them all, but so far I have not met them. If I did, I would. If everybody's listening, give me a call.
Yeah, Forest Service
I'd love
people.
To, anybody, at, mountain people, travelers, I would love to talk to you about your travels, but. I think it just goes to illustrate that these areas are not well known and that they are in fact special and that we need to recognize what we have in them and work to maintain the character that they have.
Mm-hmm.
And as an earlier point I was saying, I was trying to illustrate some of the issues by looking at and talking to the people that work and live in the area and recognizing what's important to maintain their status, what we do to perpetuate the wilderness in the future, how do we go about maintaining what we have? And I think those are larger issues that are not tackled in the book. The book basically is an introduction to the wilderness areas through pictures, through people that I've met along the way, and Forest Service people, users, and the animals that live there. I did run into several different types of critters along the way too that
sure.
are part of my story. But
the wildlife.
Yes.
Well, before we'll keep talking about the book, but let's remind people out there if you're listening, the book is called Alexander 18, and people can go to the website, which is Alexander Wilderness, right?
Correct.
.com.
Yes, and I have the book in draft form, and I've been working like mad to get it out. I'm hoping by the 1st of February that it will be available in electronic form, which I'm finding is a fascinating way to go about it. I've got it a publisher, but it's the hard copy is still a couple of months away. They've got to
okay.
take the time to produce the paper and all that, but electronic version is just as fast as you can fly over the internet. So, so hopefully that'll be out. And when that does, it'll be announced and available on my website. And I will probably at that point do some book signings with when it comes out in a hard copy at Hearthside. It should be in a couple of months. So,
Larry Johansson, did you find that it was easier to get a publisher after you had already published Extra Tough and you kind of had made a name for yourself with that book?
Yeah. The company that published my first book wanted to publish this one, and it wasn't so hard to convince people that I was serious about having a book, especially the theme of the book, I think, has resonated very well. And if you go to the website, I have introduced, there's a gallery I put up of one picture from each one of the wilderness areas. So you can go and take a look at get a representation of the type of photographs that are in the book. And I think even that will whet everybody's appetite as to learn more about that. And I would be remiss if I didn't mention the fact that there are a committee of local environmental groups and people who are interested in the 50th anniversary of the Wilderness Act that are starting to meet on a regular basis about the 2014 50th anniversary of the Wilderness Act, and hoping to be able to talk about the intent of the Wilderness Act and to reaffirm it. And a lot of our discussions have been to look to see to hand it off to the next generation, which is important because of the fire in the belly of the people that put the act together and got it created needs to be passed on to the next generation, and they need to find the same inspiration and answers that people we found in wilderness needs to be passed on. And that's a big focus of the 50th anniversary is maybe a passing of the torch, a reaffirmation of the wilderness values. And if you're interested, there are meeting announcements. I'm not sure when the next one. They just had a meeting last Tuesday, but there'll be more on that. And I will have that actually on my website once I reaffirm when the next meeting is. I'll put it up on the website so that anybody's interested.
Okay,
AlexanderWilderness.com.
AlexanderWilderness.com. People, if you're interested in the 50th anniversary of the Wilderness Act, which will be in 2014, that's a very important date. And maybe the Forest Service can get involved as well. I know we've had a guest on here.
Yes,
they already are. Okay.
Yeah, Steve Kimball is heading up the group, and folks from Audubon, Wilderness League, and Sierra Club, and people that just like to walk in the wilderness are involved too, so citizen-based for sure.
Great. Well, maybe Alexander 18, your book will become official kind of, I don't know, symbol of the 50th anniversary.
I hope it'll add to the talk and the excitement about the idea of wilderness and being able to recognize that we have some of the most fantastic wilderness in all the world.
Yes, we do, and people should appreciate that. So, Larry Johansson, I appreciate you coming on the show. It's been a great half hour. Of course, it goes way too fast, but we can have you on again once you've been selling your book and talk
love
about
to come back.
Its
right.
impact on the people here and elsewhere.
Thank you very much.
So, we've been talking with Larry Johansson. He's author of Extra Tough, An Alaskan Way of Life, as well as Alexander 18, A Story of the 18 Wilderness Areas in the Archipelago, the Alexander Archipelago. For those listening, the next interview in the next half hour will be a pre-record. I did a Skype interview with Brian Schmidt, the 2011 Nobel Prize winner in physics, for providing evidence that the expansion of the universe is accelerating. So those tuning in the next half hour, just be reminded that interview is on Skype. So hopefully the sound worked out okay on that. Thanks again, everyone out there, for staying tuned, and talk to you in the next half hour. Bye.
80%. That's 80.
In this half hour, I'm excited to have on the line one of the Nobel Prize winners from 2011 in physics and part Alaskan, Brian Schmidt. Remember, if you're out there listening tonight, you can like the Alaska Identity Project on Facebook or follow it on Twitter at Alaska ID Project. And remember, if you're interested in going to the World Quest Trivia Fundraiser on Friday, February 3rd at 6:30 p.m. at Centennial Hall, you can support the Juneau World Affairs Council and their fundraiser for the year. More information can be found on jwac.org. Again, that's the World Quest Trivia Night on Friday, February 3rd. Brian P. Schmidt is a distinguished professor, Australian Research Council Laureate Fellow, and astrophysicist at the Australian National University, Mount Stromlo Observatory and Research School of Astronomy and Astrophysics, and is known for his research in using supernova as cosmological probes. He currently holds an Australia Research Council Federation Fellowship. Schmidt shared both the 2006 Shaw Prize in Astronomy and the 2011 Nobel Prize in Physics with Saul Perlmutter, Adam Riess, and Adam Riess for providing evidence that the expansion of the universe is accelerating. Schmidt was born in the Montana Mountains, and when he was 13, his family relocated to Anchorage, Alaska. Brian attended Bartlett High School in Anchorage and graduated in 1985. He earned his B.S. in Physics and B.S. in Astronomy from the University of Arizona, and his M.A. and then Ph.D. from Harvard University. In 1994, he moved to Australia, where he currently resides. Welcome to the show, Brian. Thanks for coming on today.
My pleasure, Adrian.
Yeah, so I'm glad we worked out these different time zones and we could figure out. Thanks for taking the time. I know you have a busy schedule, but it's important, I think, to get the word out about your achievement and what you've done. So I first like to start off just by asking you a question. What was it like when they called you and told you you had won the Nobel Prize? Did it come as a surprise?
Yeah, it was a bit of a surprise. I have to admit, I initially thought it was practical joke of one of my students, but soon kind of figured out what was going on. So anyway, yeah, it was pretty exciting.
Very nice. And after that, did you have a lot of calls from Alaskan media outlets? I'm sure other ones called you, but what about Alaska?
Well, I had a couple. Mainly had just, you know, teachers and friends. I'm still in contact with a lot of my Alaska friends. And so, yeah, I had a lot of contact, mainly with just people I went to school with back in high school.
Back at Bartlett. Okay.
And
in the past, did you follow very closely past Nobel Prize winners?
Well, not exactly. I mean, you know who they are because they've done been part of big things in physics. And so, I guess you sort of pay attention to what's going on. I particularly know the ones in my area of study. They're not very common. So, yeah, you pay attention to it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was looking through the list today, and I didn't see very many female names.
That's one of the problems of physics, which we're slowly addressing. Almost half the physics PhD students we have now, at least at my institution, are female. So hopefully the things will be better downstream.
Okay, and that's in Australia, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Great. Well, let's start out kind of explaining in non-science terms, or as much as possible, what the discovery is that you found out about the expanding universe.
Okay, so back in 1929, Edwin Hubble discovered that the universe itself was expanding. And that means he discovered that the further away a galaxy was away from the Earth, mm-hmm. the faster it was moving away from us. And just like stars on a balloon that you blow up, if you measure how far each of those stars are apart as you blow the balloon up, you'll find that the further the stars are apart, the faster they move apart as you blow the balloon up. And so that's sort of the idea of the expanding universe. Now, what we did is we were able to take Hubble's experiment one step further. We were able to use the fact that light takes time to travel through the universe. And so by looking at further and further objects, we were able to look further and further back in time. In our case, we were able to look back about 8 billion years in the universe's past and see what the universe was doing back then. And so what we expected to see was that the universe would be slowing down in its expansion over time because the gravity of everything in the universe will pull on the universe and slow that expansion down, just like the Earth's gravity does when I throw a ball up in the air. Mm-hmm. But what we found instead was that the universe was speeding up, meaning that gravity somehow was working in reverse. And so that is what we call the accelerating universe, or the acceleration of the cosmos, and that is what the award was given to us for.
Wow. Now, were there some previous theories that you kind of made incorrect? I was reading about the Big Rip theory, which I don't know if something you built upon or that is now no longer valid.
Yeah, so I mean, the real question when I started this program in 1994 was I wanted to know what is the ultimate fate of the universe? Because if the universe has a lot of gravity in it, it will slow down so much that the expansion of the universe will stop, then start going in reverse. So that's analogous to the ball falling back to Earth when you throw it up. Mm-hmm. And the whole universe would eventually end sometime in the future in what I like to call the Gnab-Gib, which is the Big Bang in reverse, backwards. Mm-hmm. And so that was what I wanted to test. Was the universe going to end like that? And so it was, as I said, a bit of a surprise to find the universe doing something completely wrong, which was speeding up. And so previously, we just thought the universe had normal stuff in it and had normal gravity and should be slowing down. And that was the fundamental thing we overturned.
Wow. So you can look in a telescope and see back in time almost, right? That's kind of what
we're
looking at.
Well, we actually see in time. So, for example, right now I'm talking to you from the other side of the Earth.
Yeah.
And the light takes, you know, a tenth of a second to get between us. And so we, you know, you're hearing me and your listeners are hearing me in the past rather than the present. Mm. And we use the same technique on a much larger scale with our telescopes to look back in the past.
Wow. A lot to think about there. Now, you were part of a team before this, right, which maybe you mentioned this 1994 date, but the HIGH-Z supernova search team?
Yeah, so that was a team that I was part of and helped found in 1994.
Okay.
So, you know, these projects you just can't do by yourself. They require a huge amount of effort. And so I was one of 20 people who worked on this project. And I was very lucky in that as a very young scientist, I was 27 when we started this program. And I was one of the youngest people on the team. The youngest person was the other winner of the Nobel Prize, Adam Riess. Mm. And the two of us were allowed to sort of run the project. And that was something our older colleagues allowed us to do. And so that team is what did all the work of going and measuring exploding stars we call supernovae. And those are nice objects because we think we know how powerful they are, how many watts of a light bulb they are. And so we can measure their distance by how bright they appear. And so we can look back in time and see these very bright light bulbs, measure how bright they are, compare that to how many watts we think they are, and figure out how far away they are. And that is a critical ingredient that this team did to find the accelerating universe.
Wow. Now, was the team, you said 20 people made up of people from around the world. Is there certain countries that are more interested in this than others?
Well, it was really a very international program. I was in Australia. There was a good-sized U.S. contingent. That was the biggest group. I mean, the U.S. does probably the most astronomy of any nation in the world, but, you know, it's other nations are catching up. There were several Europeans. We had someone at one point from South Africa. So, you know, it was a really multinational program.
A good mix. You know, a couple years ago, I was interviewing, when I lived down in Chile, the head of the European Southern Observatory, and they had just discovered, there was breaking news about finding a supernova, I believe, that was 265 times more powerful than our sun. Do those kind of news stories get as much attention as they deserve? Do you find that people are very interested in this work?
Yeah, I think astronomy tends to get a fair bit of attention around the world, and so, you know, it's about anything. You don't want to flood the media with just run-of-the-mill things. We got to keep things that are exciting.
Mm.
But I think astronomy is quite topical to people. They can sort of understand what we're doing. And so, you know, I think most astronomers consider it it's part of their job to, you know, tell people around the world what we're doing. And so we get a fair bit of media coverage compared to other sciences especially.
Huh, and get support. There's this curiosity about what's out there, right?
I think everyone goes out, looks at the sky, and says, huh, wonder how that all works. I mean, it's just very unusual for someone not to be at least a little bit enamored by looking up into the sky.
Yeah. So the expansion of the universe, is there something specific that you guys know that's driving this? And does this also relate to dark energy and dark matter, which I believe is 96% of the universe, correct?
Yeah, that's right. So we actually think 95.5% of the universe is stuff we don't understand.
Uh-huh.
So back a long time ago, it was realized that if we went out and we tried to account for gravity in the universe by, you know, how much gravitational attraction there was across the universe, there was always a lot more gravity than we could see stars or see stuff. It was always about a 7-to-1 ratio. And so over time, this missing material that didn't seem to be in the form of stars or anything we could account for in terms of atoms, mm-hmm. became known as dark matter. So we've known about that for a long time.
Okay.
Since about the time I was born. Now, dark energy is the stuff that we have apparently discovered. So what would make the universe speed up over time? Well, as I alluded to earlier, we need gravity to push rather than pull. And Einstein in 1917, when he was figuring out his formulation of gravity, which we call Einstein's equations of general relativity,
mm-hmm.
he realized that there could be energy tied to space itself. And this stuff, by his equations of gravity, unlike Newton's equations of gravity, this stuff would cause gravity to push rather than pull. And he, in 1917, said, well, maybe this stuff exists, and that's why the universe isn't expanding like my equations seem to think they might be.
Hmm.
Now, 12 years later, it was realized the universe actually was expanding, and he said, oh, well, that was a stupid thing to do. And now, in 1998, when we made our discovery, we came back and said, oh, actually, Einstein's, what he called his greatest blunder, inventing this energy tied to space, actually, it seems to be right after all. And so that stuff, that energy tied to space, we call dark energy.
Okay. So there's a difference. At first, I thought they were the same, but dark energy is what's discovered, and dark matter is not known still.
Well, so dark energy and dark matter, we can both see it. It's effect due to gravity. One pushes, one pulls. Together, they make up 95.5% of the universe. And unfortunately, the 4.5% of the universe, atoms that we're made out of, well, we understand that stuff pretty well. But this other 95.5%, we can see its effect, but it's we can't actually hold it and measure it in experiments. So it's pretty mysterious stuff.
Wow. Now, about the speed of this all, I was also reading about the discovery announced of these neutrino particles breaking the light speed of light, I guess. Has this been confirmed? I know they're doing some experiments, and how does this relate to your work with expanding universe?
So the faster-than-light neutrinos are, I would say, in their early years, I would say most physicists are very skeptical still of that result, but I think it's really interesting. If it's correct, and it hasn't really been confirmed yet, if it were to be correct, it would be huge. It would just completely change the laws of physics, at least from a cosmologist's point of view, in a fundamental way. Doesn't mean your car isn't going to still, your car is still going to stay on the road and things, but you don't... from a physicist's point of view, it's a huge change, and it who knows where it would lead over time. But at this point, we're not sure. So because we're not sure, I don't think I have any idea yet how that relates to my work. We'll have to wait and see. But if it were to be true, it's a fundamental discovery that would probably open up a whole new way of thinking about how physics works. And, that's the way computers were invented, were by understanding quantum mechanics. And I don't know where it would lead, but it would certainly be interesting in the future.
Definitely. Now, to piggyback on that, there was also some discoveries with this parallel universe, which I still don't completely understand, string theory. But does that also relate to your work at all?
Well, maybe. So string theory is extraordinarily complicated, and I would be lying if I said I understood it.
Okay.
String theory is typically done in 10 or 11 dimensions. Mm-hmm. General relativity is done in 4 dimensions, and you and I live in 4 dimensions, but from our point of view, it looks like 3.
Okay,
so whenever you add extra dimensions, things get very, very complicated. And string theory is trying to combine all the forces of nature into one super theory. And so it's trying to combine the ideas of quantum mechanics and gravity. Now, that's something that has eluded physics for the last 70 years. It's really, really hard. It's the great prize out there for theorists who are trying to understand how the world works. And so our accelerating universe, the dark energy that appears to be driving that, seems to be related to both quantum mechanics and gravity. And so there is a great hope that somehow this discovery is going to tell us the answer to how quantum mechanics and gravity work together. But no one's really pieced it together.
Okay.
String theory, it turns out, in order to work at all with this dark energy, seems to require that there are a whole vast array of universes, more than you can possibly imagine, mm-hmm. out there. We happen to be just our own one little part of that whole super universe that goes on, you know, effectively for infinity. And how we're going to be able to fit into that, it's not clear to me. I always tell these people, just give me something I can measure, mm-hmm. and I'll go out and do it. At this point, it's still numbers and equations, and they haven't really been able to give us much to measure.
It's really hard to measure. So are people that look at this theory also thinking about other life forms because there could be other dimensions?
Well, I think the main idea would be that, you know, the other dimensions are going to be kind of funny dimensions compared to what you and I are used to.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't even think we have an idea of how physics works very well on them. But, you know, it does mean the universe is a huge place. And so there's an infinite number of possibilities for life and things to exist out there. So it is possible to connect it in that way, as, you know, how likely is there to be, you know, another me or another you out in the universe? And that's an interesting philosophical question, which I don't have the answer to.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
Well, bringing it back to Earth and bringing it back to Chile, where I had talked to some people working at the Southern Observatory, the European Southern Observatory, they put in some of these very large telescopes, as well as, I believe, recently the ALMA project. Have these advances or these new telescopes been able to aid the work that you guys are doing?
Most certainly. So, you know, we did a lot of our work with the European Southern Observatory, and they actually, several of my colleagues are there, and I do a lot of work with them all the time. It's a great observatory. And so our work was essentially made possible by the development of new technology. And the European Southern Observatory, but also Keck and the Gemini Observatories here in the United States and other places, the Hubble Space Telescope, were all technological advancements in telescopes that helped make it possible to look back through the eons of time and to make these measurements, which were, you know, 25 years ago too hard to make,
mm-hmm.
and 13 years ago were just barely possible.
So what do you hope will be next in technology that would help you guys out in this field?
Oh, that's a big question. I mean, what we're really looking for are two things.
Mm-hmm.
We have the much talked about the James Webb Space Telescope. That's the replacement for the Hubble Space Telescope.
Right, James Webb.
That will be amazingly powerful. Unfortunately, it's proving to be amazingly expensive.
Hmm.
And so, you know, that will be a great thing if NASA is able to make it affordable. And so, you know, that's a big thing for us. The other thing are what we call extremely large telescopes.
Okay.
There are two U.S. projects. We in Australia are in consortium with one of the U.S. groups. And there's another U.S. group based out of California. Mm-hmm. And then there's the Europeans. And all three are looking at plans to build telescopes whose mirrors are between 25 and 40 meters in diameter. So, you know, you're talking about a telescope which has to move to the accuracy of a millionth of an inch.
Oh, wow.
And be completely aligned to a millionth of an inch, weighs, you know, 1,000 tons, and is the size of a football field.
Mm.
So, you know, they're huge. And those will allow us to look back to essentially almost back to the time of the Big Bang. And so those are the other key ingredients, I think, for our future.
Excellent. Now, do they have talk of where they would put those yet, the ELTs?
Oh, yeah, the ELTs, there's really two places on Earth that stand above all others for putting optical telescopes.
Mm-hmm.
The one is in Chile, mm-hmm. which is the Atacama Desert, the driest place on Earth. And this mountain range comes right out of the ocean, the Pacific Ocean. So you get the nice, smooth air of the Pacific going across onto the Andes Mountains.
Mm.
The other place is Hawaii, where the Mauna Kea comes out of the Pacific. You have nice, smooth air from the Pacific, and you have this 4,000 meters, so 13,700-foot mountain standing out there all on its own. And so that is the other great place. So one of the telescopes will be put in Hawaii, and the other two put in Chile.
Put in Chile. So none in Alaska.
No, Alaska's got many, many good things, but it turns out doing astronomy of the type I do, not its strength.
Isn't that good? Oh, well. Now, moving a little bit into public policy, I was reading an article where you were quoted as saying that science should inform public policy, which I'm sure a lot of scientists say. What would you say are some of the possible policy implications from the expanding universe discovery, if any?
Well, I think direct policy implications right now, not much, because
mm-hmm.
the basic research I do in astronomy takes typically decades or even centuries to feed back into things that really are a public debate. But there's plenty of ways. So I'll give an example. One of my colleagues in Australia was looking for evaporating black holes predicted by Stephen Hawking.
Mm-hmm.
Now, he never found those. But in being able to try to look for those, he had to figure out how to combine radio waves that were bouncing around the galaxy. And then he realized that he could invent the idea of Wi-Fi with the same technology.
Uh-huh.
And so he took this idea of evaporating black holes and invented Wi-Fi. And he's a very, very rich man now. You know, he's made hundreds of millions of dollars from that idea.
Uh-huh.
So you don't really know how the work we do in astronomy is going to feed in to everyday life. But ultimately, you know, some of it does, some of it doesn't. But it provides the revolutions and understanding that we need to move society forward.
Definitely.
That being said, science does feed into public policy in other areas. For example, climate change or stem cell research or, in our case in Australia, water management. It may be my father is a biologist, so fisheries management in Alaska.
Mm.
So these are places where, you know, science doesn't give black and white answers. It always gives an idea with some uncertainty. Scientists need to make those discussions and be frank about them. And then politicians need to listen to the consensus of scientists rather than what they do, for example, in climate change, which is suddenly become scientists in one single area where they have no expertise.
Yeah, we've seen that, haven't we? And of course, funding for research as well, right? Do you find that living in Australia, there's more support for that than versus the United States?
Well, no. I mean, so Australia is doing very well right now. Our economy is booming. It's actually the economy in Australia is very analogous to Alaska when I lived there.
Hmm.
So Alaska was at the height of the oil boom when I was in high school, and Australia is in a whole commodity boom right now. That being said, the U.S. can still be very proud of investing heavily in research, and that is why, you know, the U.S.'s economy has remained so strong for so long, is it keeps on inventing new things from that basic research. Mm-hmm. So, yes, basic science always wants money, but I'm a pragmatist. We need to balance that with everything else, and I would hate to see it fall dramatically because that will just, in the long term, hurt the nation. But on the other hand, I also respect the idea that we don't need to probably double it either.
Mm-hmm. So what's next for you, Brian? Are you going to continue in this path with this discovery building on it, or are there some other things that are on kind of on your bucket list to look at?
Well, yeah, I guess I like doing all sorts of stuff. So I am working a bit on dark energy and trying to understand it, and I'm currently in Paris and working with a group here on exactly that topic. Mm-hmm. But I'm also doing other things. I work on trying to discover planets and trying to understand, why Pluto is not a planet and whether or not there are other objects like Pluto. I look at the birth of the universe, as the first black holes and stars and galaxies in the universe were formed. So I like to do a whole range of things in astronomy. Mm-hmm. And I have my other things. I one of the things I can do in Australia where I live is I run a vineyard and a winery, and I live on a farm, and so I get to do that as an extra challenge to my life.
Wow. Are there any wines we should buy? Do you have your wines in the United States?
Unfortunately, no. I'm a very small producer, as you might imagine, because I do all the work myself. And one of my high school friends is one of the wine importers in Anchorage, but it's very, very challenging to import wine into anywhere into the United States. And at this point, it's just probably not going to happen.
Oh, man. And just before we wrap up this interview, any reflections on your time in Alaska? And when people ask you where you're from, do you still say that, or do you just say the United States now that you're an expat kind of?
Oh, I definitely say I'm from Montana and Alaska.
Okay.
I'm very proud of my being brought up in Alaska. I loved it when I was there. I still love it. I was there in June this year with a bunch of friends from high school. We all got together and, went for it turns out I was on a cross-country running team at Bartlett, and we all went for a run together and had a great time. So it's a very important time in my life. It's one of the best times of my life. Honestly, if I had to say what's the best time of my life, my high school days in Anchorage were probably, quite frankly, the best time of my life. Extraordinarily happy, and it also kind of built up all the skills and I guess way of looking at life that I needed to be successful. And so I think that sometimes we think of Alaska kind of being detached from the rest of the world, but it isn't. It's really a great place to live, a great place to grow up, and I wouldn't have traded that opportunity for anything ever. I mean, it was an amazing time for me.
Wow, wow. Well, well said. And we'll try to ship you some king crab from here in Southeast.
Yes, that's, you still have king crab?
Yeah.
My father's a biologist in Kodiak, and so
oh.
I got to watch the king crab of Kodiak fade away when we lived there.
Mm, yeah, it's definitely not open all the time, but.
Yeah.
Well, I appreciate taking the time, Brian, and good luck with everything in the future, your endeavors, and try to touch base again in the future.
My pleasure.
Okay. And
thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks to listeners out there listening to the Alaska Identity Project. This is Adrienne Lopez interviewing 2011 Nobel Prize winner in physics, Brian Schmidt. Thanks, everybody. See you next week.